to trust or not trust the state's figures on coronavirus. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida's numbers on COVID cases, tests, and deaths differ from those of Rebecca Jones. Jones was the manager for the state's COVID-19 dashboard. She was fired and alleges that she was let go for not manipulating the figures to allow the state to reopen faster. So she started her own dashboard, and she joins us live. Also, the pandemic is forcing more people to meet with their doctors over the internet and by phone. Telemedicine is not new, just taking on new significance during the quarantine. There are people with little access to this form of treatment, though, and we're going to meet two FIU doctors who are trying to change that. And finally, why did the members of the Hallandale Beach SWAT team resign? And could it change how other small cities look at their law enforcement departments? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Dr. Anthony Fauci told lawmakers on Capitol Hill yesterday there's been a disturbing surge in coronavirus cases in states across the country, including Texas, Arizona, and Florida. South Florida remains the epicenter of the pandemic, accounting for more than 50% of total cases in the state. Miami-Dade County has seen a rapid rise in cases over the past several days, and a number of hospitals are seeing their ICU bed capacities dwindle. Now, this comes as the Florida Department of Health is changing their guidelines on how hospitals report ICU beds. Rebecca Jones has been following these numbers closely for months. As a science manager for the Florida Department of Health, she played a critical role in creating and monitoring the statewide dashboard for COVID-19 data. Jones was fired from that position. A statement from the Florida Department of Health says it was due to, quote, repeated acts of insubordination. Jones says she was asked to manipulate data in the dashboard, and she refused. Now she started her own COVID-19 dashboard that's been funded through a GoFundMe account. She joins us now via Skype. Rebecca, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
And I do want to note that we did reach out to the Florida Department of Health seeking comment and making them aware of Rebecca's appearance on the show. We received a lengthy statement, which we will read excerpts throughout this interview, but we'll post the statement in its entirety online today. Rebecca, I want to start with this. How widespread do you believe the virus is within Florida compared to what the Department of Health is currently reporting?
Oh, wow, that's a tough question. It's really difficult to say because without any kind of planned or logical testing scheme, we can't really say how prevalent it is.
So when we look at the numbers that they're reporting, how accurate is that? Can I trust it? Is it more or less of what they're telling us?
It's much more, and it's partly because of the limited access to testing, the log in basically how far backup testing kits that are received are tested, the number of epidemiologists that are working on any given day to be able to process that information. But the main limiting factor is testing.
Is it by a lot or little? I mean, again, when I'm looking at those numbers, what am I supposed to be thinking?
A lot. There are a lot of studies that range about the estimates of how many or what percentage of people in any given place have the virus. In Florida, they think the confirmed amount says a solid at least minimum 5%. In other countries, there have been studies that show that by August, we'll be at 50 or 60%. So from the information that we have, which is incredibly limited, I would say that we have at least 15% of the population of Florida positive, but we're nowhere near being able to test that many people to prove it.
So the state is changing how it is reporting ICU bed capacity. In the statement that was presented to us, Alberto Moscoso said this, quote, "The new reporting is current number of COVID positive patients currently receiving ICU level of care. The old wording was current number of COVID positive patients admitted into ICU beds. DOH has heard hospitals are utilizing a portion of their ICU beds to specifically house and isolate patients with positive cases of COVID-19, including those that do not require intensive care. So this change in wording is made to more accurately capture the number of COVID-19 patients receiving intensive care." That's the quote. What are your thoughts on their approach now and that change?
Well, we've always known that the hospitalization data that we have is unreliable. A lot of people don't even get tested until they've reached the point where they need to be hospitalized. And then they receive their test and it can come back days later. Sometimes there would be a lag in several weeks to several months of when we found out a person who was positive was hospitalized. So the current hospitalization rate, I know from having worked that data, is not reliable. It's also not the data that I use on my dashboard. I actually just show the number of available beds, period, regardless of who's occupying it, that the state has. And right now, the entire state of Florida has about 1,400 available adult ICU beds across the entire state. Their change in language and reporting doesn't affect how many beds are available. And to say that somebody who's in an intensive care unit, doesn't require intensive care and could be essentially kicked out of the ICU bed if someone needed it. That kind of situation usually only happens if the immediate care, which is essentially a step below intensive care, beds are full. So there would be nowhere to kick that person out to. And it's a very irresponsible way of looking at patient-level care. But it's not the number I've been using anyways, so it doesn't actually impact the number on my dashboard.
Where are you receiving your data? How are you gathering that?
Well, all of my data is from authoritative sources. Most of it is from the Department of Health. The hospitalization data comes directly from the Agency for Healthcare Administration, short for AHCA. They produce a live feed that was actually scripted while I was there by the Florida Department of Emergency Management and Esri, the software builder, that tells for every half hour how many beds are available of varying types. And the ones that I specifically pull out of interest are ICU beds, isolation beds. The ICU beds are broken down by both adult and pediatric. So those numbers are shown by hospital across the entire state, and that is straight from AHCA.
You were responsible for overseeing the state's COVID-19 dashboard. Take us back to the spring, when the dashboard was initially created. What was the intended purpose?
So I had actually asked to build a dashboard in January when the state first knew that we had community spread. And the response that I basically received was that, well, we don't want to start a panic, or it's not that serious yet. By Valentine's Day, we were monitoring several hundred people. I actually canceled my plans with my husband that night after I saw the numbers for that day. Finally, after I think the public demanded information, I got the go-ahead to build this essentially information and data portal. So I built the dashboard, I built the data systems behind it, aggregated all the data, produced these APIs that anybody, news or otherwise, researchers at universities, could easily just plug in and get the data. I kept it up and running. I made sure it was updated every day by 11. I was only ever late once, and that was actually the day after my parents lost their house on Easter in a tornado in Mississippi. So, yeah, I had that running really smoothly, and it was supposed to be our public face of information. So, an easily consumable way to get the most important data about what was going on at the time.
Were you working on that by yourself, or were you working with your colleagues to put this together?
Oh, I built a dashboard completely by myself. And I managed it every day by myself. It was not until late April that I had anybody who could even just update the data.
And the Florida Department of Health, did they give you any guidance as when you were putting it together and what they wanted to see or what should be in it?
Of course, the epidemiologists I worked very close with to make sure that I understood the data I was presenting, that I was explaining it properly. To the public and to the press, and I made sure every step of the way everything was being used appropriately. The last thing that I ever wanted to do was to release information that didn't have the needed context, to come with it and cause some kind of a panic.
So again, as you've stated, you allege that the Department of Health asked you to deliberately manipulate that data. When did that start happening? Was it a particular person, or were you getting memos or something, and people said, let's think about how you're presenting this?
There were little more passive forms of controlling the information that happened throughout the entire process. The end quote leadership of DOH, which was a group of people in a room we rarely ever saw, wanted to review every single case every single day before we published anything. And they would often come back and tell us to remove things. That was kind of one of the smaller things that was pitched as like a data quality control, but it was really for people who had never seen the raw data and had no idea really what the data meant. The big thing that I had a problem with was the weekend of April 26th, when the deputy secretary of the Department of Health actually asked me, among other things, to go in and manually change numbers, to change, 18% positive to 10, so that a county would meet the threshold to be able to reopen. All of the really inappropriate and unethical things that I was asked to do happened in that next week.
So they asked you to change the number, and as you said, from 18 to 10, this is part of the reopening process. They wanted to see better numbers. So they were actually asking you to change the number. They weren't looking to say, well, if we remove this data and that data, that gets us to the 10%.
They did that as well, yes. And I didn't protest because I felt like it wasn't my choice or my place even to kind of dictate policy on what we considered for reopening. Like we were supposed to originally, by the epidemiologist's recommendation, include pneumonia syndromic data with our influenza and COVID-like illnesses for ER visits, because more than half of all the people who have died so far that we know were COVID positive were also diagnosed with pneumonia. It is a important key indicator of COVID-19, especially before we had widespread testing. And so that was supposed to be included. The only problem with that is it's extremely high, much higher than it normally is this time of year, and wasn't showing any sign of decreasing. So they just removed that. They said take pneumonia out altogether. And I didn't protest that because I thought, okay, well, if the epi team approves of it, then so be it.
And, we heard, well, in our statement that we did receive from the Department of Health, Alberto Moscoso again said this, quote, "It is patently false to say the Department of Health has manipulated any data." So at what point did you start to, because you said you didn't challenge them at the beginning, when did you finally say no?
When it came to changing the numbers, I knew that the dashboard was the face of this response and that it had bipartisan support and it was trusted. It was actually held up as the gold standard of data transparency by FEMA and the software developer, and all over the country, this was being shared as pretty much the best that you can do. People trusted it, and I knew if I started deliberately putting in wrong numbers, it would be tantamount to me using this trusted tool to lie to people and say it was safe to start resuming normal activity when it wasn't.
The Department of Health requested that you resign from your position as the Geospatial and Science Manager. You declined. Who was asking you to quit?
The Deputy Secretary.
Do you know if it goes beyond the Deputy Secretary? If somebody higher
I'm
up had asked that?
a scientist, and so I don't deal with speculation, and I can only speak to what I personally experienced.
All right, so ultimately you were fired. And again, their statement, repeated acts of insubordination. What was going through your mind as you're considering the consequences of this decision?
Which decision, to not
To not
manipulate the data or to quit?
to right, not to not quit, because they asked you, quit. They wanted you to leave.
They gave me, the better part of a week to think about it. And then the governor defamed me on live television in front of the vice president, and everything kind of swirled out of control. And I would like to, point out that I did not encourage or participate in any of the press coverage that week until Friday. This all happened Monday. That the article, first article came out. I had no idea it was coming out. I found out about it when somebody else emailed me for a quote, and my phone stopped working because I was receiving so many calls at once. And I didn't say anything publicly that week. And to have seen it spun out of control, to be called not a scientist, and some of the other just ridiculous and stupid things that the governor said, I thought that I wasn't really given a choice in the end. Because one of the requirements of me resigning with, a bit of cash award, was that I can't ever sue the state. I could never bring a legal case against the state for anything relating to my job. And considering I had requested to file a whistleblower complaint the day before they asked me to do this, I did not want to sign away that right.
Again, I'm talking with Rebecca Jones. She launched a community-run COVID-19 dashboard. She was fired by the Florida Department of Health where she was a manager responsible for the COVID-19 dashboard for the state. Now, she's created her own, again, as we mentioned, and we've posted a link to it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Rebecca, when did the idea come to create your own dashboard?
It was a week or two after everything had kind of started to settle down from the initial circus. And my husband said something to me that, you know, was kind of hurtful at the time, but really stuck with me. And he said, you know, our family's been drugged through the mud. There were UK tabloids that published pictures of our children, our young children, and their names and their birthdays. A UK tabloid, when I had never said a word. And he said, you know, what, you lost your job, all of this. Why? What did it change? He said, what did it change? They still changed the numbers. They're still lying to people. You know, everything happened even though, you know, you didn't do it. So why bother? And it really bothered me that that was right, that I hadn't changed anything. I hadn't stopped anything from happening the way that they wanted it to be done. And so after being a bit down about that, I thought, well, you know what? I have these skills. I can do something about it. I can get the information out to people. And that's what I'm going to do. That was my job before. That's my job now. This time the people are just paying me directly to do it.
What is like one or two big things that, you know, that differs between your dashboard and theirs? What is it you're doing that they're not?
Well, I added a lot of data that they repeatedly told me I couldn't add, including the hospital surveillance data. So one of the key indicators in trying to assess whether or not our healthcare system can absorb a spike in cases and then, you know, consequently a proportional increase in hospitalizations and ICUs is how many beds we have available at hospitals. And as I mentioned earlier, we have 1,400 adult ICU beds available in the entire state. Based on current hospitalization, based on historical hospitalization rates, that's more people that will be hospitalized that were diagnosed today. And that is a serious indicator. I also added resources. So I always wanted to add testing sites to our dashboard. You know, people are coming here, they get this information, everything's bad, awful. Okay, well, what can I do about it? How do I take control of myself and my life in this situation? And one of the easiest ways to do that is to get tested. The fact that DOH never allowed us to publish in any place where the testing locations were, their contact information, and all of that information that had to be gathered by an academic group, nonprofit, the GIS Corps, was stunning to me. So I've added that as well. So you can actually go to my dashboard, click on your county, and search by your address and find all of the testing centers near you and their hours and their contact info, and whether it's a drive-through, whether you need a referral, you can search by all of that. In 5 minutes, you can have a map printed out to get directions to whichever facility is nearest to you. And that's incredibly important.
So as I mentioned, we did receive a lengthy explanation from the state. We will be posting that online. But I wanted to read, you know, some of it here. Here's a list of looking at the concerns with the differences between the two dashboards. Here's something that they had mentioned. The Department of Health's dashboard reports total cases using total number of individuals with positive test results. This is the standard method of diagnostic testing for COVID-19, and antibody test results are provided separately. The RJ dashboard, your dashboard, however, simply adds the total number of individuals with positive antibody test results to the number of individuals with positive PCR tests. The DOH dashboard reports deaths in Florida residents, which is in accordance with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommendations. The RJ dashboard incorporates non-Florida residents' deaths, which is contrary to CDC recommendations. Again, this is part of their explanation they sent to us. Do you want to speak to that criticism?
Yeah, let's break that down one by one. So first of all, the number of total DOH cases is on the homepage of my dashboard. And the number of antibody tests, positive and negative, is actually broken out separately, also on my dashboard. The DOH dashboard doesn't show any information at all about antibody testing. Mine does show them separately. You can click on the testing tab and it'll have one column that says the regular molecular testing and one that says antibody testing. They are separate. The second issue about reporting non-residents to the CDC. This isn't the official data feed to the CDC. This is a public information tool. The public doesn't care whether or not somebody's a legal resident of the county that they died in. If they were sick here and they died here, that is what matters. This is not the only information to report to the CDC. It never was. So there's no reason to use that as a justification to not show the public that information.
Is
And
there
I'd
any
like to
fear?
remind DOH that they do provide non-resident deaths in their actual data. That's where my data comes from. There are two columns, resident and non-resident. The CDC pulls only from the residents, so showing both has no impact whatsoever on what the CDC is reporting.
Have you faced any retaliation from the Department of Health for your own dashboard? Have you heard from the administration?
I have not, luckily. I know that there's been a lot of, like the statement that you just mentioned, false things that are just plainly not true. But I think that they came at me with everything they had back in May. And there's really not anything else in my life to dig up that you could use to hurt me. They've disconnected some of their API feeds, which means I just have to rebuild them, which is no big deal because I built all of them in the first place. They have changed the way that they're calculating ICU beds, which they only decided to do after months of this response when I published them on my dashboard prominently. And I know from people I've spoken to at DOH that they've actually asked people to take a look at my dashboard and try to copy it to improve their dashboard, which isn't surprising considering I built the original one, but it's a kind of weird sort of flattery in a way. But at the same time, no. What can they possibly do to hurt me at this point? It's their data, it's public data, and that's all that I'm using.
You've been in touch with colleagues that are still there, and they've told you that there's still requests for data manipulation.
Every day. I have several contacts there who, one of which has actually filed a report with the Inspector General, who are ready to leave, who are ready to speak out. I have cautioned them to really consider what that means for them and for their lives. I didn't have a choice in being thrown into the spotlight. It happened without me knowing about it. It happened without my encouragement. And they do have that choice. And honestly, I could never ask anyone to intentionally subject themselves to the kinds of things that me and my family went through when it first became public. So I really hope that they weigh that and they decide for themselves what they can sleep with at night.
I mean, it seems to me that, you look at the information that's posted up every day by the Florida Department of Health, and I'm just wondering, how much trust that we can have in it. You're pulling data from them anyway, but you're making the claim that they're manipulating the data. There's data that's not complete, that they're changing.
Yes.
So what is it then that people should trust?
Well, I make clear on my dashboard where those changes are happening. So, over the last week or so, several hundred to potentially over 1,000 cases have actually been deleted from the DOH data. So, now on the homepage of my dashboard, I put a special marker for counties where from one day to the next, they actually lost cases. For today, Calhoun went down 18 cases from where they were yesterday. So I make sure that that information is known. It is unfortunately the only means that we have of getting confirmed positive information about residents in Florida. We have to work with that. We have to understand its limitations and its nuances. And I've worked really hard to kind of explain those on the dashboard, including how things are changing and reporting and any kind of discrepancies within the data. But at the end of the day, it still is the official data. And without, any kind of alternative source that we can vet and know for sure is correct, which I don't even know if one exists, there's no alternative way to do that.
I mean, in the end, again, it's you make that claim. There are people, you say, also making that claim that there's manipulation of data. But is there going to be, do you want to try to find a way to prove that beyond just saying it? Isn't there a way to say, can we prove it? Because you've got to expose it.
Oh yes,
If
I
you
have
want.
thousands of emails, text messages. I've kept the receipts, as they say. I've been in contact with the House Oversight Committee, the House Judicial Committee. I've been speaking with Nikki Fried's office. There are definitely receipts, and they will be made public.
Are you going to continue to run your dashboard for a while? How long can you keep it going?
I'm still looking for a full-time job, but as long as people, continue to donate and support this effort, then I can continue to work on it. And I think if the people value it, then that's where my obligation lies because I started that first dashboard. And I need to make sure that what it's saying is provided in the right context in an honest and transparent way.
And you think about, the fact that there's a push to reopen the whole country, not just the state of Florida, but we're moving into July, especially the July 4th holiday. What's your biggest concern?
My biggest concern is some of the recent things I've heard from DOH employees is that the only reason we're allowed to see this very dramatic uptick in cases, the largest that's ever happened today, which I'm sure they'll attribute to their change in reporting times, but is that they're allowing this giant increase over the last week to play out so that they can begin restricting the number of cases they publish next week and advertise this as proof that they're over the hump, that they've passed their second wave, even though this is really the peak of the first wave. And that's going to give false assurances to people, and they will consider traveling when they may not have if they knew what was really going on, and that they'll continue to have these large events over the holiday weekend and eventually the RNC with no real idea as to how bad it is. And that could cost a lot of lives.
And why are reporting times so critical?
Well, if you change reporting times, basically the way that it's always been done, the way it's been done since the beginning, which they changed yesterday, is that whatever data was in the system when the report was run, which is usually about 8 a.m., was reported. And that included cases that came in that morning. Yesterday, they decided to stop doing that. So they only reported the previous day's cases, then they cut it off at midnight. Which made it look slightly lower because none of the cases from yesterday morning were included in that report. So now they're reporting by a 24-hour day instead of report to report, which is why we had the giant uptick today instead of yesterday.
Again, we've been talking with Rebecca Jones. She launched her own community-run COVID-19 dashboard that's following coronavirus deaths, infections, and testing. You can learn more about it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And also, as I mentioned, we do have the full response from the Department of Health about their dashboard and, of course, about their claims of Rebecca's dashboard being different. We'll be posting that online as well. Rebecca, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, still to come. How is telemedicine being used to serve our most vulnerable populations, especially today? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the COVID-19 pandemic has changed a lot of aspects of our lives, even how we receive medical treatment. Instead of showing up at a clinic, a lot of patients are just urged to download an app or turn on the webcam or just call in. Studies suggest that telemedicine and in-person visits have similar outcomes, but they haven't looked at what this means for uninsured and low-income minority groups. A new study from Florida International University is going to look at just that. We're joined now by Dr. Sahar Ojabshir. She is an assistant professor and the principal director of this study. Dr. Ojabshir, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having us.
Also joining us is Dr. Sarah Stumbar. She's an assistant dean at the university and a co-investigator on this project. Dr. Stumbar, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Dr. Ojabshir, I want to start with you. You had the initial idea for this study. What's the biggest challenge right now of doing telemedicine within low-income communities?
So due to limited resources and lack of personal protective equipment amidst the COVID-19 pandemic, many of the free clinics have essentially closed in March to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in their offices. And then they started providing extremely limited telemedicine services to their existing patients, but not accepting new patients. And these closures has affected many vulnerable and uninsured patients' access to all primary care services, such as medication refills, chronic disease management, and acute care visits. And with the loss of employer-based insurance among millions of Americans who have lost their jobs, it's very important to find a solution to maintain and expand the access to healthcare for these vulnerable communities in South Florida.
So a big part of it, and telemedicine is not new, but trying to get it to certain people, because there are people, this technology may not be that accessible, right? That's the challenge.
Yes, exactly. So telemedicine is not new. It has been used even before the COVID-19 pandemic, but during the past 3 months, it's been used more among clinics. But currently, there is not much known about the racial, ethnic, and sociodemographic differences in utilization of telemedicine among vulnerable populations in South Florida.
Dr. Stubbar, tell us a little bit about this study, and again, because you've received a grant now to help you move forward on it, but can you tell us a little bit about what it entails?
Sure, of course. So part of our goal with this grant actually was to increase the telemedicine capacity of the clinic where we're performing the study. And so with some of the grant funding that we've received, we will be able to buy an improved, expanded telemedicine platform for that clinic so that they're able to enroll new patients and see multiple patients at the same time through their telemedicine platform. And so with this study, we hope to expand access for the very vulnerable community that's served by the clinic, and also study the characteristics that might be associated with patients who are more willing to utilize telemedicine. I think we all know that it can be intimidating to download a new app or receive medical care in a new way. And our hope is that through this study, we'll be able to find out what some of those barriers are and help to mitigate them in the future so that we can expand access to more people.
And my understanding, too, because you're paired up, you're working in partnership with the university with a community-based primary care clinic, right?
Yes, that's correct. So this is a primary care clinic in North Miami that Florida International University has a long relationship of providing care there and also educating our students in the social determinants of health at this clinic. And so through this partnership, we're able to both increase their resources and expand opportunities for our students and our faculty.
I want to hear from both of you on this, but Dr. Stubbar, I'll start with you. I mean, clinics like this one are really important considering who they're serving. But I think, as I just heard, I mean, we've got a lot of folks now who've lost their jobs, lost any insurance they had or the ability to get that care. Remind us of the role these clinics play, how important they really are.
Sure. So particularly in Florida, which we all know is a state that chose not to expand Medicaid a number of years ago, we still have a huge millions of people who fall into the coverage gap and don't have insurance through the Obamacare ACA exchanges and also not through their employers. And so these clinics really serve a role in filling that gap, providing primary and preventative services that hopefully not only treat diseases, but work to keep our patients healthy. And we're serving particularly vulnerable communities that often, if you're not outreaching to them, if you're not learning how to work with the communities that you're serving, you lose them because life is so challenging, and it's only been more challenging by COVID-19, as we all know.
And that's an interesting point, Dr. Ojabshir. I mean, with the COVID, especially, how do these clinics help? Because this is a pandemic. This is different than the typical care that we need.
Yes. So just adding to what Dr. Stubbar just mentioned, this is a nonprofit volunteer-based clinic that provides free healthcare services to low-income and uninsured members of our South Florida community. And in order to provide tailored telemedicine services to these vulnerable communities, we first need to understand how they are using it to take the next steps. And this is very important. And we have been collaborating with this clinic on other research projects, and we hope to make the study findings available to the public.
Again, I'm talking with Dr. Ojab Shear and Dr. Stumbar from Florida International University. They are leading a study on the use of telemedicine in underserved communities during this pandemic, and they just received a grant, as mentioned, too, in helping in their study. Dr. Ojab Shear, I wanted to play off something that Dr. Stumbar mentioned a moment ago, that it can be intimidating for some folks to download an app and then deal with their doctor like that. We're so used to just going to the clinic, being there, seeing the doctor in person, being able to talk to them, about our issues. And I don't know, for some people that might be kind of tricky. How do you help people get past that?
So currently the clinic is offering both in-person services and telemedicine services. So each patient that calls, they will have an option to use telemedicine or in-person services. And we are studying what may be some of the reasons. Maybe language is one of the reasons that some patients may prefer to go to the clinic and be, in closer contact with their providers and, some cultural or educational disparities.
Now, of course, one of the challenges is, you with the grant, you can expand the services within the clinic, but again, you're dealing with underserved communities, and in some cases, they may not have that access to high-speed internet and computers. How do you help that? How do you fix that part of the situation?
So I can speak a little bit to that through another free clinic where I work. We've been providing only telemedicine services to our uninsured patients over the last 3 months. And I was very skeptical in the beginning that our patients would be able to have phone minutes for the phone calls or have internet for the Zoom telehealth platform that we're using for video visits. But on the whole, our patients are so eager for the support from their primary care physician to ask us questions about COVID-19 that as long as we're willing to be flexible with them, maybe do a phone call visit 1 week and a few weeks later a video visit and really be patient and walk them through the steps and sometimes convert a visit from video to a phone call if the internet's not working. Our patients have been so receptive and so grateful that we are adapting to the environment in which we're currently living. It has not been as big of a barrier as I anticipated that
yeah.
it would be.
And Dr. Stumbar, I was wondering what the feedback has been. So it's been positive then.
Yes, hugely positive. Everyone right now is frightened to go to a hospital or go into the physician, but they still want to manage their diabetes, their hypertension, their anxiety, which has been so worsened by COVID-19. And so any way that we can facilitate that, patients have been incredibly receptive to seeing us in whatever capacity that is.
Dr. Ojab Shear, just wanted to know what you're hoping to get from this study. What practical use can we gather from this, to help our clinics?
So as I mentioned, currently there is not much known about the racial, ethnic, and sociodemographic, such as age differences and gender differences in utilization of telemedicine among vulnerable populations in South Florida. So we hope that the findings of this study serve as a basis for future telemedicine interventions among underserved communities in our South Florida. And also this study will provide an opportunity for FIU students to be involved in more health disparities related research projects while practicing social distancing.
Again, we've been talking with Dr. Sahar Ojab Shear, an assistant professor and a principal director for this study at FIU, and Dr. Sarah Stumbar, an assistant dean at the university and a co-investigator on the project. Thank you both so much for sharing with us, and best of luck. We'll bring you back. We got to talk about this when the study's done.
Thank you so much. We love that.
Thank you so much for your time.
All right. Well, still to come, 10 members of a Broward SWAT team resigned from the department. We're going to learn reasons why. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, as protests continue across South Florida calling for criminal justice reform and an end to police brutality, there's been a shakeup in one Broward County law enforcement unit. 10 members from the Hallandale Beach SWAT team resigned earlier this month, citing a lack of training, equipment, and, quote, being restrained by the politicization of our tactics. Now, the story has gained national attention as the role of law enforcement units in society is being called into question. Brooke Badinger has been following the story for the Sun Sentinel. She joins us now. Brooke, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with understanding when the SWAT members at the Hallandale Beach Police Department decided to quit. What happened before that?
It boils down to basically recent protests against police brutality in Hallandale Beach. And what the members of the SWAT team say, you know, is the stress of working in this political climate surrounding these protests. So that's what led them to, you know, quit the SWAT team. But they are still employed with the Hallandale Beach Police Department. You know, so these 10 squad members have been working the protests in Hallandale Beach. And like you said, things got heated when a city commissioner, Vice Mayor Sabrina Javayana, participated in one of the demonstrations.
That demonstration, interestingly enough, so she was there with some of the protesters. And then I don't know how many, but there were protesters who started chanting a particular name while they were on their knee, Howard Bowe.
Yes. Yeah, so the Howard Bowe case happened in 2014, and that was when a 15-member, you know, SWAT team raided Bowe's home in a narcotics investigation, and this happened in Hallandale Beach. And they showed up to his home, you know, 6 a.m. They shot and killed his chained pit bull outside, broke into his duplex door, deployed a stun gun, or stun grenade, rather, and shot him while he was standing in his kitchen, all while he was unarmed and he was in his underwear, and he died in the hospital 11 days later. So his family, you know, they sued the city and four of the officers who were involved for his wrongful death, which includes one of the officers who resigned 2 weeks ago, Officer Christopher Allen, who was also involved in that. So, you know, eventually a Broward County grand jury determined that his homicide was the result of justifiable use of deadly force, and his family won a $425,000 settlement in 2018.
What change within the department? Did anything change within tactics, or just again the particularly with the SWAT team?
Yes. So after Bowe's death, they reformed their policies. The department did, and their practices. According to the mayor, Joy Cooper, they addressed the use of force, implemented body cameras, they instituted de-escalation training and diversity training, and they also became accredited.
Now, one of the things, and as I mentioned, the SWAT team is making claims that they haven't received enough training and support. What exactly are they asking for from the city, and what's been the response?
They you know, don't ask for much directly. They just say that kind of generally that these conditions basically need to be, you know, rectified and addressed, they say. And until then, they can't in good faith carry out their duties. But they did reference, you know, the city administration hasn't budgeted enough to address those training and equipment concerns.
Now, I said 10 members of the SWAT team had resigned. First of all, do we know how big the SWAT team is? Is that a majority of them?
I believe those are the ones who at least have been going to the protest recently. That's the detail that they've had assigned to the protest.
I see. And they didn't quit the police department. They just quit the SWAT team.
Right.
Okay. Again, I'm talking with Brooke Badinger, the reporter from the Sun Sentinel, talking about the story of the 10 members of the Hallandale Beach's SWAT team that resigned, citing a lack of training and support from the department, but also, again, links to a lot of the protests that we see and the pushback from the community on police tactics. You could read her stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So one of the things I wanted to get to is this question of what is the city doing? We see this throughout South Florida. We see it throughout the country. Again, a push by protesters to either defund or dismantle police, to make changes. What are they asking of the Hallandale Beach police?
The protesters?
Yeah.
They protesters have brought up this, you know, call to defund the police, and they brought up kind of this history of the SWAT raids between 2006 and 2014 in Northwest Hollandale Beach, which is historically Black. And Vice Mayor Sabrina Javayana has said that that's why she compared Hollandale SWAT team to the Minneapolis Police Department. She said the community, you know, has their own George Floyds and Breonna Taylors that the city must address before it can heal and reform. And, you know, she was kind of critical of this same issue back in 2018 when she was a Hollandale Beach resident before she was in elected office. But that's been a lot of what the protesters have also been, you know, saying and referencing during these protests.
Is there an effort to either bring the SWAT members back or just replace them with other people? What's happening to those officers right now?
Yeah. So right now, the team's duties are covered through a mutual agreement with neighboring departments. But the mayor, Joy Cooper, has said that, you know, she hopes to reinstitute the team, basically, not necessarily with the same officers. But she says that, you know, the SWAT team serves this important role. They protect two large venues, the Big Easy Casino and Gulfstream Park, which has thoroughbred racing and, you know, shops. So she said that that's an important thing, but no specific or like official efforts that I know of just yet to reinstate them rehire.
What are we hearing from since the resignations? What are we hearing from the police chief?
Gosh, you know, I haven't spoken with the police chief personally or heard what she's been saying, but I just know that the mayor has been, you know, pretty outspoken. She just said that the current, you know, Bo's tragic death basically is not representative of the current department since they've reformed their policies. And then city manager Greg Chavaria acknowledged the team's, you know, displeasure with the police chief taking a knee during the protests. But he said that that gesture was not in support of Javayana, which is what the SWAT team had alleged.
What are the circumstances, Brooke, if you know, when the SWAT team is called into action in Hallandale Beach? Because, and I say that because Hallandale Beach is, I mean, it's a smaller community compared to some of the bigger cities.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, what are you asking specifically?
So, yeah, what are the circumstances when SWAT is called? Do we know?
I guess we don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, not specifically.
You know, I wonder, too, if have there been any conversations about just not having a SWAT team in Hallandale Beach? Has anybody brought that up?
No, not that I've heard of. We'll certainly be following this case and, you know, looking at any calls or efforts to defund local police agencies that develop in the future in South Florida, but none specifically from Hollandale Beach that we've heard of.
Yeah. What's next in this story? What's happening now?
They met with, you know, the police chief and the head of the police union met to discuss the resignations and their grievances. The mayor said that she followed up with chief of police unions and just ensuring that they're going to try to address those concerns that the SWAT team has about, you know, resources and training.
Hmm. Well, again, as we mentioned, 10 members of the Hallandale Beach SWAT team had resigned, citing lack of training and support. Again, a lot of this happened as the protests started to ramp up throughout South Florida and the country. And you could follow Brooke Badinger's and the Sun Sentinel's reporting on this story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. And if, by the way, you happen to live in Hallandale Beach, we'd always love to hear from you, your take on this story. You can always find us, again, Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Brooke, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that is our program for this Wednesday, June 24th. Sundial Senior Producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. By the way, the theme music for this program is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo. You can find them online, gobalo.com. Remember, you can always download the podcast of the show. I mean, it rebroadcasts at 8 p.m., so you can go back and listen again if you missed any parts of it. But if not, you want to listen on your own time, just go and look WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. And we always would love to hear a review from you. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to speak with Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez. We're going to talk about the new face mask enforcement and the possibility of the county having a civilian oversight panel to investigate cases of police misconduct. Plus, the Seminole Hard Rock Casino opened this month. how are they preventing the spread of COVID-19? And by the way, if you happen to go to the casino, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us what's going on inside, because if you've ever been in a casino, those places are packed. People are in there very tight. What are they doing to try to protect the customer? Plus, we're going to hear from teachers who are entering retirement, who have had to say goodbye to their colleagues and students virtually. And by the way, if you happen to be one of those teachers, if this was your last year, you can always still reach us tomorrow. We'd love to hear from you. Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. But we're going to hear some great stories coming up tomorrow. By the way, just want to mention too, tomorrow we're going to make the announcement. We're bringing back the Sundial Book Club. And tomorrow we're going to announce the July title. Put a little bit of a tease on the Facebook page. Find us on Facebook, Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. And it's great to bring back the book club. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.